This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, mother and daughter Jeannie and Dana Scott talk about how their lives changed after Dana came out as a lesbian. But first, the arrest of a Kalamazoo doctor by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents has brought new attention in Southwest Michigan to the issue of immigration and deportation. The first reporting of the story of Lucas Neese came soon after a Detroit-area man was deported to Mexico. Jorge Garcia came to the United States when he was 10 and was deported after 30 years in this country. We're going to discuss what these cases tell us about immigration with Susan Reed. She is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Thank you for being here, Susan.
Thank you, Gordon.
I want to go back to something that you said to Channel 3 regarding Dr. Neese, that you said that this was an example of the system working as it was designed to work. How so?
Sure. Well, and just to be very clear, you know, my office is not representing Dr. Neese, and I don't have any more information about that situation than other folks do. But based on the sort of basic framework, which is a person who is a lawful permanent resident being detained by immigration and charged with deportation, apparently based on old criminal convictions, right, that ICE will be alleging meet the standard for deportation.
Going back about 25 years. Right.
Exactly. Going back in this case, quite a long time and to some degree, an unusually long time. That is the system that we have. Non-citizens are very vulnerable to deportation. In 1996, a large number of new grounds for removal were added to the law. And those included, for example, virtually any controlled substance conviction other than possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana, and a number of other types of convictions that made people deportable. And again, just to give you an example of how this system was designed to work, people who pled guilty to perhaps cocaine possession as a youth or possession of more than 30 grams of marijuana at a time when it was not a deportable offense, became deportable in 1996. And so I think one of the things that surprised people most, right, was this idea of, well, but these convictions were so long ago. Our system was designed to have that not matter if at any time. Not only does the government, if at any time the government becomes aware of something, they can pursue deportation, but if at any time after a conviction, the government freshly makes that a ground of deportation, you can be prosecuted for deportation. So it's a system that is really designed to be extremely punitive, and it's not a system that's designed to have a lot of consideration of equities.
And one of the things that we have found out about Dr. Neese's case is that ICE says this sort of came onto their radar because of encounters that he had with the police over the years, 18 of them. Some of these are speeding tickets. Some of these are things which are a little more serious. But is it a combination of these two things, or is that what it appears to be to you, that it's these two convictions from long ago plus these so-called encounters with police?
Yeah, you know, there are lots of ways that people come to ICE's attention long after a criminal conviction makes them deportable, or come to ICE's attention because they actually just don't have a status. And, you know, a couple of common examples would be green cards have to be renewed every 10 years. So after that 1996 law that I mentioned earlier, all of a sudden in 2006, people go to renew their green cards and, oh, this conviction that's 10, 15, 20 years old is suddenly coming onto the radar for the first time. Another thing that frequently gets folks put into deportation proceedings is actually when they apply for citizenship or apply for green cards and don't end up being eligible. Those cases often get referred to ICE. So I always think that's interesting when people say, oh, well, you know, why didn't this person just apply for citizenship? Well, often if you don't have the right advice, the right analysis, the right knowledge, or the government gets it wrong, it's applying for citizenship that gets you put into deportation proceedings. But in this case, I thought it was particularly chilling to hear this language come from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that apparently what prompted their action was that there had been police encounters. You know, our Constitution promises us due process, and I don't know what a police encounter is. I've been practicing immigration law for 15 years. It's not a special immigration law term. I don't think my colleagues who do criminal defense exactly know what a police encounter is. And so to see the government taking action that could be devastating against a person based on this number of police encounters, how many encounters is too many, Gordon? Can you get 5 speeding tickets before you get put in deportation proceedings? Can you only get 2? If the police come and ask me a question and I answer it, is that a police encounter? What if I don't answer it? Is that a police encounter? I found that language of police encounter as the impetus for this prosecution to be very unsettling from a civil liberties perspective.
You mentioned that there should be due process. How quickly can things move in terms of deportation, and is there adequate time for an organization, maybe like the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, to provide an adequate defense for someone who may be facing deportation?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges. One reason we get involved at all is because, unlike in criminal proceedings where the Supreme Court has said that due process requires that an attorney be appointed for you if you cannot afford your own attorney, that does not apply in immigration proceedings. They're
considered civil. So you don't necessarily get a public defender.
Absolutely not, no. And so there are people who are detained and deported who never, ever speak with an attorney about any defense that they might have to their deportation, about any civil rights violations that might have happened in the context of their detention. And actually, even if your Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure are violated by ICE, you have to show that it was an egregious violation in order for that to defend you against your deportation. So it's not like on Law and Order, right, where if Lenny and the boys make some mistakes, then the DA gets after them because it messes up the prosecution. Often when ICE makes mistakes, it doesn't really have an impact on the prosecution. So there's a real incentive problem there. In terms of other challenges, the detained docket actually moves really pretty quickly. The wait right now for a bond hearing is very long, and I think we saw that come forward in this local case where it takes about a month to get a bond hearing. But your actual process moves reasonably quickly, and if you can afford counsel, or if there's a well-funded nonprofit able to assist you, which most of the time, unfortunately, there is not, about 90% of people who are detained don't end up having counsel. If that all happens, if you're detained, the process moves relatively quickly, you know, with time to prepare your case. Non-detained people in immigration proceedings, the cases take years. I have court dates scheduled for 2020.
I want to talk a little bit about the case of Jorge Garcia.
Sure.
Over in Detroit. Someone who came to the United States at the age of 10. He was here 30 years before he was deported. How common is this, and is it likely to be more common if there is going to be stepped up enforcement?
Well, a case like Jorge Garcia's got significantly less common in 2012 when President Obama created the DACA program. The problem for Jorge Garcia is he was actually too old to benefit from DACA. Folks had to be under 30 to benefit from DACA. And so that creates an interesting dynamic where here's Jorge Garcia in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, older than most DACA recipients. So by most calculations, you'd think, gosh, well, this guy has more equities, to use the legal term, right? He's been here longer. He has his family. But he was outside of the DACA program because he was too old. If that doesn't seem fair, well, welcome to the immigration system. You know, so for the people, though, who did manage to be in that DACA group, President Obama's 2012 decision to initiate the deferred action program for that specific group of people who did have, who and still do, right, have so many equities, did stop a lot of those folks from being put in deportation proceedings, right? And what would that have looked like? Well, in Jorge Garcia's case, he applied for a green card through his U.S. citizen wife. I think most people who watch movies, right, think that if you marry a citizen, you get a green card. A lot of people don't even seem to think there's an application process, right? It's just magic. But in fact, lots of undocumented people, even though they marry citizens, even though they have citizen children, are not eligible for green cards, are not eligible for citizenship. And like I mentioned earlier, it's applying that triggers the enforcement. I would say Jorge Garcia's case is uncommon in that he just missed that DACA threshold, and DACA has been protecting so many people for the past 5 years. but 122 people lose DACA every day since the Trump administration's September 5th decision to terminate the program. And starting on March 5th, many more, many thousands of people will lose their DACA every day. And, you know, really just to underline one more thing, again, because it gets a little circular, right? I'm just seeing a lot of why didn't they apply for citizenship? They're not eligible for citizenship. They applied for the first legalization program they were eligible for, the DACA program, and that's what they're asking for.
Once someone is deported, of course, Jorge Garcia's family is hoping that they're going to be able to get him back here. But once somebody is out of the country, how tough is it then to get back, you know, regardless of, you know, even if there's a change in law or there's a new court ruling, how tough is it to get them back here and get back to square one?
It can be very difficult. And that's why that family, you know, fought every year for discretion following him being ordered deported and received that discretionary grant from the Obama administration every year for, I believe, the past 6 years. Again, I'm not counsel in that case either, but I'm more familiar with it. It can be very difficult for a number of reasons. A deportation order generally comes with a 10-year bar to reentering the United States. In some cases, it's a 20-year bar, and that bar can only be waived in certain circumstances. There is an application process for a waiver. Some immigrants may trigger other bars when they depart the U.S. that have to do with prior unlawful presence. That wouldn't be the case probably in Jorge Garcia's case, but I suppose it could be. Again, it's not my case. In his case, I assume that the family will begin the process of seeking those waivers, but it can take years.
Oftentimes in the whole discussion of immigration policy, there's this talk of sort of a middle ground where maybe some people don't actually have a pathway to citizenship, but they can stay here legally. And there's a lot of, you know, guest worker programs and those sort of things. But I wonder if these examples that we've talked about, Dr. Neese and Jorge Garcia, if they maybe don't demonstrate that if you are not a citizen, there is some limbo there. That is, citizenship is probably the only way to get yourself firmly on the other side of not being someone who can be deported.
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of our core values at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center is equity for immigrants and immigrant communities. I think equity is an American value. And to put people in a position, which I totally acknowledge, you know, there are movement voices who said we should have just taken work permits a long time ago and we wouldn't be suffering the way we are now. And I really listen to and respect that perspective, that going for the brass ring of citizenship has just not been attainable and has left people vulnerable. I think some hidden concerns in addition to the ones you mentioned, that ongoing vulnerability to deportation, is a scenario that I'm seeing a lot, which is aging undocumented parents of U.S. citizens, right? Not eligible for Medicare, not eligible for Medicaid, no Social Security. You know, we often have that call from that family that says, we are paying cash for my mom's dialysis because she's undocumented. She can't work anymore. How can we get, often it's the dialysis center, honestly, calling to say, how can we get this person's status so we can get them this health care that they need? Well, you know, the first bit of bad news is there's usually not a way to do that. And then the second bit of bad news is, even if we found that green card needle in the haystack, you're not eligible for Medicaid until you've had your green card for 5 years. So as I see a generation of people who have worked incredibly hard in some of the most dangerous industries in our country, aging and dealing with the same human disability and age-related challenges that we all face, I see a generation of, in this community, predominantly Latino families entrenched in poverty because the costs of caring for their aging undocumented loved ones are going to prevent them from investing in their children's education, investing in homes. That's a phenomenon that I see that's real. And so I really think that a path to citizenship is an important value, even as politically challenging as that is appearing right now.
Susan Reed is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. As always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. When Dana Scott came out as a lesbian at the end of the 1980s, her life started to get better. She was 27, and she'd struggled for years, pretending to be something she wasn't. After she came out, Dana's mom, Jeannie Scott, stood by her side. But privately, Jeannie took the news hard. Dana asked her mom about that experience last September at People's Church in Kalamazoo. Both were attending a reunion for lesbian group Lavender Morning. Here's Dana Scott, followed by her mom, Jeannie.
So, Mom, yes. I came out when I was 27, and you and Tracy, my sister, took it pretty well, really, although I don't know what you two talked about in private. So what were your thoughts when I first said, I think I'm a lesbian, or I am a lesbian?
I was devastated. But you didn't actually tell me. Actually, your ex-husband told me. And I called Tracy, your sister, immediately and said, Dan said Dana's a lesbian, and I don't believe it. What do you know about this? And she said, it's not something we can talk about now. It's like, all right. And I cried, and I went into your dad in the living room and said, Dan said Dana's a lesbian. And he's like, yeah, football game or something. And I was devastated because, coming from a mother's point of view, I felt like I was a failure. I had not given you what you needed to have a healthy marriage and a relationship and to wear pink dresses with a ribbon in your hair. Now, to be perfectly honest, I did believe over the years that you possibly could be a lesbian. But my thought to myself was, I don't really care as long as she's happy. That's the only thing I care about, is that she's happy. But when I actually knew it for a fact, it was devastating. I was embarrassed. It was very, very hard.
Well, you did a good job of hiding that, because I felt very supported, honestly. I mean, I kind of look back, and I had no idea that my ex-husband did that, so that doesn't surprise me, but it's like, well, okay. But I appreciate you, because I don't know what happened, or maybe you saw that I was healthy and happy, because, you know, I quit drinking and had, you know, some support systems and was doing rather well, so maybe you saw that. And so you weren't as worried, or no? Okay. What changed your perception? Because in the last 20 years, you seem to have been very supportive of me and my any partners that I would have or anything like that. So what changed?
I had to wrestle with it for quite a while, but what really changed for me is I told myself, this is my Dana, this is my daughter, this is my child that I've known for 27 years. This is Tuesday. I love her. On Wednesday, she's gay. I still love her. She's not any different. She's the same person. And it's my daughter, and I love her, and I'll support her in whatever she chooses.
I remember Dad, who was not supportive at all. His main thing was how it reflected on him, I think. And I remember him saying, don't be bringing anybody over here with spiky hair and, you know, looking like a man or whatever. But he definitely struggled with it. Over the years, he got better with it or whatever. Yeah. So thank you for just being supportive and stuff. I mean, it is who I am, you're right. It is what it is, and there's no changing it. So, and I remember I felt really free, finally, when I was able to be who I was, and that was really important. So, yeah. And a lot of folks don't have family, so.
And I think that Tracy, your sister, took it very well. It wasn't a problem for her at all. She is who she is. It was very difficult for your dad. And it took me a long time because we both worked at Bronson Hospital. And some of the people would say to me, I heard Dana's gay. Is she gay? And I was mortified. How could I tell anyone my daughter was gay? It was horrible. It was my secret.
Yeah, we both had a secret.
But I wish that people, when parents say, I just cannot accept this, I wish that they would step back and know that this is their child, and who they were on Monday is not any different than who they are on Tuesday. And I, at this time, I'm very, very proud of you. You've turned into a delightful young woman. I am supportive of you and all the other people that have gone through this. And I wish that more parents would be more understanding and realize that it's not a choice, that it's something that happens for whatever reason. And then if they go, well, I could never have a gay child. Well, how can you say that until you actually have one? You know? So it's difficult for the parents also.
Are there any ways you can think of that it has enriched your life or made you a different person?
Yes, I think so. I think knowing the lesbian community, because you've included me and your sister into it a great deal. I mean, everyone's very accepting, they're very kind, and it's shown me a different exposure to things that I wouldn't have been exposed. Like some of the dances, it's hard to tell who's, in my eyes, who's the male and who's the female. But I am non-judgmental, you know? I mean, it's like, this is who they are. But that gave me an experience that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't have been involved in your life. If I'd have cut you loose, I'm more enriched by your lesbianism, if that's a word.
So it's funny because, you know, I think that Dad or you maybe even thought, well, she wants to be a man. That's what the whole thing is. And it's never about that. It's, for me, it wasn't. And for most lesbians that I know, it's not about wanting to be a man or look for a woman who looks like a man necessarily. It's really just about being a woman in my body, how I am, and not necessarily the stereotypical woman that society says, you know, we should be in order to be accepted or to be genuine. Now, I think that's a common misconception for not only the older generation, you know, older than me, your generation, but even now I think sometimes there's that misconception. And really, you know, everybody has a different experience. But for the most part, it's just about two women who love each other and are fine being women. And same with the men, they're fine being men, they just, you know, fall in love with other men. So it's an interesting thing, interesting concept, or misconception, I should say.
This is West Southwest. We're listening to an interview between Dana Scott and her mother, Jeannie Scott, about what it was like when Dana came out as a lesbian. Here's Jeannie.
If people would just sit back and realize that what you see visually is not necessarily who they are. And I think people take the visual look and feel uncomfortable. And I think part of it being uncomfortable is because it's unfamiliar. But I feel very fortunate that I have Dana in my life and that she's such a delightful young woman. And yeah, you said you'd pay me later. And that I get so many good compliments about her and what a real person she is. And I think that comes from her life experiences, that she is kind to other people because she knows what it means to be ridiculed. She was ridiculed on a Sunday school bus one time and would not. Everybody's like, what are you, a boy? I mean, that's what I heard. And she wouldn't go back to Sunday school. So there were a lot of negative things in her life that she did face because of her. She had a stocky build. Her mother kept her hair really short. She excelled at sports. And it just made her different from the other daughter who was a Cinderella.
My sister, who I adore.
Yes.
Do you remember some of that?
I do. I remember it, yeah. Definitely, you know, wanting to dress in boys' clothes, but it was more comfortable, you know? I mean, that just wasn't me. I remember my mom trying to give me a perm one time, and it was torture. And it's like, why do I have to have a perm? Like, you know? And so that was, in a way, probably her way of trying to sort of mold me into what was comfortable for the family, you know, really. And it just, you know, wasn't comfortable for me. So I wanted to wear boys' clothes. I wanted to be an athlete. And it's something I remember from as young as I can remember, that I just felt like I am not, like, these other girls. And, you know, it was a struggle, of course, because of society and stuff like that. So I think it's important for the younger folks to remember, the younger lesbians, that it hasn't always been so accepting. And I know that there's still pockets of, you know, issues and discrimination and things like that, but it's much, much better than it used to be. So.
And you should say, Dana, what years that you were going through this, because this is 2017, but you were born in,
62.
Mm-hmm. So it was the 60s and early 70s that you struggled. And then she got married, and I remember on her wedding day, we all went to fix up the reception hall and things, and Dana called me and she said, "What am I supposed to be doing?" And she went to wash her car because there wasn't anything for her to do. She had no idea, and she was heavily into alcohol at that time, so she wanted to close up the reception hall. But she married a good friend, I think. And I think that's why she said, "Well, I guess, I mean, I think she said, I'm supposed to get married, so I guess I'll marry Dan." Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I thought, well, he asked me, and I think that's the next, you know, I'm 19 or 20, so I guess that's the next step. I didn't go to college, and so, yeah, and that's what happened a lot in the back in the day, right? Because, you know, a lot of us were trying to conform, and so we did, you know, marry and have kids, and so, you know, it's unfortunate in some ways because, you know, other people are involved, but at the same time, you know, that's, again, society. It's a bigger issue than just one, you know, little pocket.
I would hope with the younger people coming back, the parents will try to be more understanding and realize that this is still your child. And I think it's changing. I think it's not as taboo as it used to be. But there may be some problems with accepting these young men and women that want to live their own life, and the parents are worried about society and how they'll be judged too.
Just because it is a Lavender Morning reunion,
yes.
I'm guessing you found your way to that group at some point.
I did. After I went to treatment for alcohol, and then I was in a process of a divorce, and I didn't have any resources. And I can't remember, somebody told me that about Pandora's bookstore. And so I went down there and kind of slyly went in, scared to death, and River was working. Asked if she knew of any attorneys, and she gave me a couple names. And then from then on, you know, I frequented the bookstore because that was a safe place, and also I might meet other people that were like me. And I also, you know, had a misconception of what maybe a lesbian looked like or whatever. And to my delight, were every shape, size, and everything. So the whole stereotypical thing of, you know, the dykes on bikes are the only lesbians, you know, it just wasn't true. But that's all I knew growing up, and it was something to be disdained at the time, unfortunately. So then, yeah, and then dances were super important to, like, to come and meet folks like myself in a safe place, women only event. So I, you know, I owe a ton of gratitude to River and Pandora's and the whole Lavender Morning community for really embracing a young, scared to death lesbian, and really with open arms. I mean, I think that honestly, in some ways, it helped save my life, really, because, you know, at some point, you know, I think I was trying to drink myself to death because I was so, so afraid and so unhappy. And so I think they were definitely a safety net, and still continue to be, really.
Dana Scott spoke with her mother, Jeannie Scott, about how Dana's coming out as gay transformed both of their lives. They spoke during a reunion of the lesbian group Lavender Morning last September at People's Church in Kalamazoo. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.